have an agenda, the Rav and I, but obviously Yom HaTzmut is a day which is so meaningful, but it also brings up maybe either certain questions, thoughts about Aliyah, about future, about one's own personal decisions in their life. And this is like a venue if people have any questions they want to raise or conversations to have. That this is a great opportunity for us to engage in those really important discussions. So without further ado. If you want to add that or you're... No, okay. There you go. So.
Okay.
Sorry,
this is too personal, but why did the two choose not to make Aliyah at this point?
I'll let you start on that.
So
we're not
going to
do anything with the recording,
right.
That's for sure.
So, we've been asked far more controversial questions than that are probably on recording somewhere, so...
So I have to disagree with the basic premise of your question that you think that I chose not to make Aliyah. Because the Seir Nagoda, the Malabed, Yoreth Le'achal Avinu in the tribes, the Chazal say, Onos Apiyah Dibor. So sometimes there are decisions in life that are made which one doesn't make voluntarily. There are a lot of factors that go into decisions, and sometimes certain decisions, for practical reasons, are taken out of one's hands. So... There are many personal reasons in my own life why I am sitting here in Washington Heights right now and not another Libby Mizrach. So if you want to know what those personal reasons are, so that's not a little personal. So that'll be more than happy to share with you. But the answer, because the question is that this particular decision was probably made for me in Shema.
So I can speak for myself, again, not to go into too many personal details, but... You know, Aliyah is something that a person needs to be very intentional about. It doesn't sort of like, almost like happen by itself. So for me personally, getting married at a pretty young age, at age 24, being here in Smicha, then having a child right away, taking on a job, taking on another job, you know, you sort of get your life started. You don't, at least in my case, and probably a lot of those cases, you don't have the money necessary to sort of make Aliyah. And then, like, before you know it, you look up and you're 35 years old and you have X amount of children, or you're 40 years old or 45 years old. And to some degree, that window, at least for us personally, for a lot of people, it sort of closes. You know, it's very hard to make Aliyah when you have a, you know, 10th grader or a 12th grader. Or if you've been in the Rabbanus and you're not going to find something, perhaps, as I felt for myself, equally rewarding as a job here, Rabbanus in Eretz Yisrael. And so without either the financial capacity, kids are older, what exactly to do there, you know, it becomes like a hard decision. And then you sort of like kick the can down the road. So I think for a lot of people it's that way. You want to make Aliyah, your life sort of starts, you wake up one day and you're just sort of in your life as it is. And at that point, to sort of change gears and then to move there to Israel becomes like very, very challenging and probably not recommended. So that's sort of my quick story, but probably applies to a lot of people, sort of that type of narrative.
Do you mind if I ask a follow-up?
Okay. Sure.
So assuming that the window is closed at this point, how do you try to make sure that Eretz Israel is in your life in Chutz La'aretz in a way that be equal in your
mind
to being in
Eretz
Yisrael for a permanent life?
It's a beautiful question.
Okay. We'll take it. So I think that's a very, very important point. And I know on a personal level, we've tried very, very hard to maintain that that cash with Eretz Yisrael in a very real way. I mean, not everybody has the opportunities that we had and has the privilege that we had, but Baruch Hashem, you know, as our families, we've had this course of spending, I think the last, I don't remember how many summers already at this point we're up to, but I don't know, close to 20, somewhere between 15 and 20 summers in Eretz Yisrael. And, you know, we've made that push, and even though Baruch Hashem has been a tremendous privilege, it's also come in a certain degree of Mesiras Nefesh, particularly on, you know, from my wife's, in terms of her career and her work. So that's something that I felt very, very important about, especially when my children were younger, to have that real connection, that they know that Eretz Yisrael is very much part of their lives. So Again, that's something that we personally was lucky to be able to have. Not everybody has that opportunity. But I think even out of the context of being in Eretz Yisrael proper for X amount of time during the year, just the literally talking up Eretz Yisrael and the talking about it and speaking about it and that if for whatever reason HaKadosh Baruch Hu, had this plan for us, that this generation is not necessarily in Eretz Yisrael, it doesn't mean that we don't want the next generation, we want the following generation. Like we try to, right? I spoke about this many times that Yosef HaTzadik wasn't Zocha to be in Eretz Yisrael for the overwhelming majority of his life. If you make a cheshbon, so Yosef spent less than 12 years in Eretz Yisrael, depending on exactly, probably less than 10 years of his life in Eretz Yisrael. And yet, out of all the people, out of all the Shvatim, so it's Yosef who becomes ultimately the one who's the greatest oid Eretz Yisrael, and he's the one who goes down in history as Ikkar Kelei Dan and his children, and it's his great-great-granddaughters with the B'nai Slavchot, who Mechavel Saaretz. So sometimes it's not necessarily the amount of time that a person is proper in Eretz Yisrael that can have that ability to create Chippus Saaretz for future Daros. So that's something that, again, and I'm not saying this as an excuse, I'm not saying this as a substitute for being in Eretz Yisrael, but for whatever reason, those who end up in Chutz Laaretz, whether justified or unjustified, only HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows the answer to that question, that it doesn't exempt us from creating that Chibas Aretz in our own homes and openly in our children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. So we don't know, where the B'nai Slavchot are going to come from in the future.
Right. And I would just, I guess, add to that or compliment that. I know for myself personally, right now at age 51, and my family being what it is, moving to Eretz Yisrael today is not an option. But in my mindset, and for my wife and I both, the mindset really is, okay, well, but it's always on the table. It may not be today, it may be 5 years from now, maybe 10 years from now, maybe 20 years from now. But, even leaving aside the Ramban and all that we've shown him, that it's a fee of Doraisa to be in Eretz Yisrael, it never stops being a dream. It never stops being something we're yearning towards. It never stops being something that we feel connected towards. And even if for any of you who will not be living in Eretz Yisrael, it should be sort of like the consciousness of but when is that going to happen? Or when might that happen? And to sort of be ready when that door opens. When that door opens, we're ready to walk through that door. That's number one. Number two, and this is something that that Rabbi Zaleski mentioned as well, deeply felt religious passion. You sort of think about Rav Kook in the 1890s, in Lithuania and other places. I feel personally, and I believe all of us can expand our consciousness, when I think about, Avraham Avinu coming to Israel for the first time, when you think about the Ramban in 1264, 1265, sort of entering into Israel. You think about Yehuda Levi sort of seeing Eretz Yisrael for the first time. To me, that is deeply embedded in my consciousness, that sense of a passion for Eretz Yisrael. And whether or not, you can live there or not live there, or you can visit 5 times a year or 1 time a year or whatever, 2 years, that love and that sense of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's gift to Am Yisrael, and that sense of the Makom HaNivchar that is so embedded in my consciousness. And I'm sure for many of you as well, you feel that as well. It's just it's like a limb of who you are as a person. And that could continue to be just sort of nourished over the course of a person's life. You think about inventing, you think about Ubnei Yerushalayim HaKodesh, you think about during the keynotes, you think about, other times of year, just to nourish that natural chiba and she'ifa. And that is critical about anything. But we're speaking about Eretz Yisrael, but... Yeah, please.
In the world of data,
just talk up a little bit.
In the world of data, if someone has that intentional desire to get to Israel ASAP, what steps would you advise them to take
in regards to dating?
Yeah, to keep that option open.
I think there are different options. Something that is different now. So, everyone hear the question? When it comes to, let's say, issues of dating and being Eretz Yisrael, how to sort of navigate that complicated sort of that complicated world, so to speak. So first of all, I'm not saying this is for everybody, but something that's very different now than it was even 10 years ago, you would almost never have, for the most part, single guys graduate at YU, and then moved to Israel afterwards. Like, it just, a few people here and there that would do it, but it wasn't part of the culture. You didn't have communities of single Americans who were there. And that's different now, you know? And therefore, the door is open for people that say, I want to make Aliyah right now at 22 and 23, and do Army, not do Army, go to school there. And that's only one, quote unquote, safe way of making sure that you make Aliyah. But that's obviously complicated also. You know, dating in Israel is probably different than it is here. Family, future, finances, et cetera, all those things as well. And the second thing is obviously, you know, when you're dating here, if you are going to date here, you are going to stay here to make sure that you're dating a girl who's equally passionate. I think it's a great failing, and I'm sure you've had this before also, and my dear colleagues are at Leibowitz and Weinberg. You know, when somebody, guy comes to me and they'll say, well, I'm dating a girl, but she has no interest in making Aliyah. You know, like, to me, those are almost like shocking words in a way, or, and not shocking words, but for someone to go through their entire sort of yeshiva education and have no desire at all to be in Eretz Yisrael. But obviously when you're dating, to date a girl who obviously you share those values and you sort of have like a similar vision for the future, both in regards to how you raise your kids and the values of the home and the shmiras and mitzvahs in your home and Israel in your home as well. You know, that becomes like part of like the shared joining together, that's part of the dating process.
So I think at least for the last few years that many of us were in Eretz Yisrael for yeshiva, so for, let's say, off Shabbos, and we would go and see different families in Eretz Yisrael. And something that was interesting to me at least to see was that in many of these families, you would have some children who were, let's say, very Haredi, and other children who were more passionate about Eretz Yisrael, maybe more spiritual, but maybe not as religious. So my question, I guess, in general is, being in a place like Eretz Yisrael, realizing that the culture, maybe the hashkafas, are either, you know, very one way or another, at least to my knowledge, I think some communities have maybe been a little bit more wayu recently. What is the level, I guess, of, emunah that goes into moving into a very different culture? And if one is going to move to Israel, should they go with a lot of friends in order to do so, or is going alone?
Everyone here, I don't know your name.
Josh.
So Josh basically raised three different issues. Issue number one, I'm not sure if you know this or not, but issue number one is the issue about the polarization in Eretz Yisrael, the sort of the complications of chinuch that are there. Everything is very either black or white. Another issue is sort of going with friends or going by yourself. And then maybe the third issue is sort of the necessary emun or bitachon necessary in any decision, but especially in making aliyah as well. So we'll allow Rostovsky to address all three of those important questions. Thank you. You're in good hands.
You know, I think Rabbi Bless alluded to the fact that a lot of the dynamics of making Aliyah have changed significantly over the last 10 years. I would say they've changed even more significantly over the last 5 years, and it's really a work in progress. There is absolutely no question that the challenge that, you know, presented itself as Aliyah to our generation, so to speak, although I find it hard to say those words, but it's true, it's a different generation. No, it is radically different. There are on so many different levels the issues of moving to Israel. Even the model, I mean, again, it doesn't take, we don't have to talk in riddles and secrets. I mean, Ramat Beit Shemesh as the model of American Aliyah right now in our community didn't exist 30 years ago. I mean, it existed maybe for 10 families, but that entire model of basically moving to Israel, and again, I'm not talking about the pros and the cons of the model, but that model exists today to basically move to Eretz Yisrael, to a community that speaks English. I mean, let's call a spade. That is a superimposed American, you know, community in Eretz Yisrael, and it grows by leaps and bounds. And next week there'll be another next hilltop over, and the next time there'll be another hilltop over, and we'll call it whatever other catchy name we call it, and there'll be a new American rabbi who comes down. I mean, that's the reality. That's the bottom line, what's going on, the trajectory today. So what that's going to mean in terms of the culture, you know, is something that only time will tell. I mean, you know, in theory, a lot of the hesitations and a lot of the fear that went into that kind of a question, I'm going to go on Aliyah with friends. What I think you're basically saying is that to move to Eretz Yisrael is scary enough. To move to Eretz Yisrael and expect my family to become completely Israeli is very, very, very scary. Whether completely Israeli means Israeli Haredi, whether it means Israeli Dati, whatever it means, it's a scary notion. And I think what's really, really been happening over the last 5 to 10 years is that this new model is emerging, and it's by far not over. This new model is emerging that you can live in Eretz Yisrael, and the cultural, necessity of becoming acculturated into the Israeli society is not as important as it was 30, 40 years ago. And time will tell where that places itself. In a way, I guess this is a YU event right now. So I think many of us are kind of waiting with bated breath and to see what role exactly YU is going to play in the next 10 to 15 years in terms of that community, because all these young couples that are going to Eretz Yisrael now, many of them already have, kids who are YU age, and many of them will have in the next 10 to 15 years. And I don't know what role YU formally and what role, American Orthodoxy informally is going to play. So time will tell in terms of that.
Let me just interpret what Rabbi Sussman just said. If any of your families want to open a branch of YU in Israel and start yeshiva there, Rabbi Sussman, I'd be more than happy to entertain possibilities of Rosh Yeshiva, Mashgiach, and we'll be in touch later if such a thing exists. But
thank you, Rabbi Bless, for pointing out what I didn't want to say, but yeah.
Listen, obviously, Josh, everyone knows the Gemara says at the beginning of Brachos that there's Shlosha Dvar Nikn be Yisurin, or Nikn be Yisurin. And one of those things is Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael has always been the necessity of being Kone be Yisurin, and in every generation that means something different, right? There's a, who I read before, Golda Meir's book called My Life, which is a great book, talking about her coming to the kibbutzim and the malaria and what she had to deal with and what she had to experience. That was sort of like the Kinyan Bisura that my grandfather dreamed of, living in Tarnow, Poland in the 1930s, of going with Hashomer Hatzair and living on a kibbutz and building up the land. That was like one type of Bisura. There's different Bisura, of course, of Yom HaZikaron, of soldiers giving their life, continuing to give their life. And I guess the Yisurin of our generation isn't the malaria. It might not even be giving one's life as a soldier. It might not be finding jobs because the economy is what it is. There might be other things. It might be the fact that to buy something in Ramat Beit Shemesh Dalid or Mishkafayim is, $1.3 million for a small, and the finances of being in Israel. Or it might be navigating a lot of the hashkafic issues that you're speaking about. How does a person find a little bit more like a centrist type of life, right? There's always been sort of uphill challenges that relate to Eretz Yisrael, like by definition, from the very sort of inception of such a thing called Canaan, of such a thing called Eretz Yisrael. And sometimes those challenges are too much. Sometimes you might feel that I can't find a place for my children, or I can't find a community, or I don't have the money, and those are sort of like real life decisions. But the fact that it's going to be hard, the fact that we're going to need bitachon, the fact that we need emuna, the fact that we have to be filled with like a spirit of doing the ratzon of Hashem and relying on Kadosh Baruch Hu, absolutely. And I would just say, as far as friends, probably some of my colleagues as well, we sometimes have like a deal with Tamidim that are trying to decide between moving to, let's say, Ramat Beit Shemesh or Mishkafayim on the one hand, and like Ramot on the other hand. That's the places people go. And like often the big decision is, well, I have more of like a chevra in Ramat Beit Shemesh or Mishkafayim as opposed to Ramot, where it's in Yerushalayim, maybe it's a little bit cheaper, this and that, but I'm not going to have a chevra that's there. My experience has been, my brother moved from Ramat Beit Shemesh 17 years ago, Ramat Beit Shemesh Aleph, is that their friends, Ravi Shemesh Aleph, have become like their family. Your family's in the States, you're going through a lot, you need to have neighbors. Like, the neighborhood has become like your family. And that's important no matter where you live, no matter what area you live in, especially if you're going to pick up and leave the United States to be in Eretz Yisrael. Like, the neighborhood, the family, the chevra, I think becomes even more central in a person's life. That's just my own experience. Yeah, please.
I think a lot of people in this room will probably agree with me that, and we kind of touched on this in this conversation, that if there was more of like a YU type community in Eretz Yisrael, then more people in this room would try to go. And I assume from looking around this room that almost everybody here is probably under the age of 24, 25, and nobody has a kid. Or if you do, they're probably very young. Understanding, with that being said, excluding your man, of course. Understanding what that being said, I think everyone here would agree with me, and the Rabban would agree as well, that we are the future of the Jewish people. You know, we are the next generation. So should we be looking at Eretz Yisrael and saying, you know what, if we want that type of lifestyle, we want that YU community there, we should go and put more of an effort to be there? Or should we say, you know what, we'll stay in America and we'll build our future here? So how much of a, to simply put the question, how much of an effort should we be putting into aiming at our trajectory in Eretz Yisrael?
Listen, I think the starting point is, again, let's sort of go back to the simple, let's say, sugya. And the sugya is not simple, but let's maybe like spend like 3 minutes talking about the sugya. So you have essentially four different shitos in the Rishonim and the Aharonim. You have the most, I guess, common shita, the most well-known shita is the shita of the Ramban. The Ramban says that tachiv v'raisa, no different than putting on tefillin. Right? Those are the words Ramban used, and the Ramban says this, I think, in five different places, right? And there are other Rishonim who agree with the Ramban. You have a small school of Rishonim, the Rashbam and the Gra, who's obviously not a Rishon. They say that it's not a mitzvah d'oraisa per se, but that's the place that a person can be mekayim the mitzvos, or more mitzvos. You have the Shita of Rav Moshe and some other Achronim that say that there's not a mitzvah, but there's a kiyum. Anybody know what the fourth Shita is? D'oraisa, that it's a sort of a hechsher mitzvah. There's a kiyum d'oraisa, perhaps. Anybody know what the fourth position is? What's that? The Megillas Esther? Who's that? We said that? Right. You said it? Yeah, so the Rambam silence in the Sefer HaMitzvos have led some to believe, and again, it's a minority position of the Rambam, that the Rambam believes that there's no mitzvah to make aliyah at all, right? But assuming, like, we'll leave that Rambam aside, because most people disagree with the Rambam, like, everybody says that it's either a hechsher mitzvah or a mitzvah d'oraisa, or it's the place, or it's a kiyum. Like, so anytime that we have a mitzvah opportunity, or we have the opportunity to be in the Eretz Yisrael, which is the place of like the manifestation of Kodesh Baruch Hu Shekhinah, like, of course, our starting point is to say, yeah, we want to be a part of that, and we want to do that. That should be the starting point, just in the way that we always say that our starting point is more involvement with mitzvos and a connection with the Kodesh Baruch Hu, right? That should be like the starting point of any sensitive Yerei Shamayim. And then the question is, like, what is sort of chipping away at that? Are there family issues that chip away at that? Are there parnasa issues that chip away at that? Are you somebody that perhaps wants to go into Avodas HaKodesh and wants to go into Rabbanos, and maybe you can't find that in Eretz Yisrael? Are there other considerations? So I think the starting point always should be, I belong in Eretz Yisrael, that's where a Jew belongs. And then each person sort of on their own life can evaluate what might be reasons that are taking me away from that. And that could probably be like a whole range of like very valid personal, professional types of reasons. But that's like a cheshbon. That's something to sort of think about in a very serious way. It's not just, okay, I'm here, so I'm here. Right? And then each person sort of has to navigate their own sort of internal cheshbon a little bit. Yeah? That's it? Okay. You know this one? Jer?
What's a ben yeshiva supposed to do on Yom Ha'atzmaut?
We'll let you do that. See, here's your Talmud Mufak.
I'll tell you the truth, I am most amazed that this question and answer is almost over and nobody's asked that question yet.
Right.
It shows a totally completely different shift in Mahalach of mindset, because 30 years ago that would have been the first and the second and the last question. Also.
18 RGJ articles about it, and this article. Yeah. But everyone heard what Jeremy asked? Aaron, you're back. So Jeremy said, what should be a halachic approach to Yom Ha'atzmaut? Is that the right? Was the Ben Yeshiva?
Yeshiva.
The Yeshiva approach.
I can't speak for every Yeshiva. I can't speak for every Ben Yeshiva. I can only speak for myself. So I try to consider myself to be Ben Yeshiva, so hopefully whatever answer I'll give will be relevant for some people here. So I think as Roy Blass used the phrase, the starting point before, so I think we could use this as a starting point here as well. So our starting point is that we always look for opportunities to praise HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's what we're all about. So we daven and we say brachas and we do mitzvahs, and we always look for times and ways and different avenues to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and we look for different ways to express our thanksgiving and our Hakaras HaTov to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in so many different ways in our lives. And therefore, we don't have to apologize for looking for an opportunity to thank the Kodesh Baruch Hu. The Kodesh Baruch Hu bestows a tremendous chesed upon us as individuals, and it bestows a great chesed upon Am Yisrael as a whole. I think that it's hard for me personally to believe that how many years have already passed in terms of this phenomena of having a state. So just to put things into perspective, and I shake sometimes when I think about this, but I was born in 1965. 1965, you can make the cheshbon, 57 plus turning 58. In the year 1965, the Holocaust had only ended 20 years before. That means I was born into a world that was barely, there was, just again, if you want to put things into that, there's more time has elapsed now between September 11th and today that elapsed between the end of the Holocaust and when I was born. That Eretz Yisrael, I mean, Medinas Yisrael, having a Jewish state in Eretz Yisrael, was 17 years old, and having Yerushalayim reunified had not yet occurred. So again, I was born in 65, then in 67. So just like to put, so it was a little bit of a different world. But now, moving the clock forward a little bit, so it's, if I'm not mistaken, I think we just celebrated 75, that's what they told me in TNAC last night, 75 years since 1948. That's a different world. That is, that's a different mindset, Legamre. So I grew up in a world of post-Holocaust, in a world where the events that occurred in the short window of time of the 1940s and the 1930s and the 1940s, culminating with 1948, was a reality, was something that was the lifeblood of the world that I grew up with, and that was incorporated into me. That notion of Hakaras HaTov, Kadosh Baruch Hu, that historical perspective of what occurred and what it meant for Klal Yisrael to have a place of their own, particularly after the events of the Holocaust, so that was something that wasn't even shayach, to question. That was a tremendous amount of unbelievable Hakaras HaTov. And I think that some of that has kind of gotten lost in the shuffle. I think that's the reality. That's the way, it always happens this way. And, Kadosh Baruch Hu bestows a tremendous chesed upon you, and time goes on and it becomes a second fiddle. My kids don't know what it means to have a world, without Eretz Yisrael. The same way I didn't know it, but my parents did know it. And my parents, my grandparents did know it. So I knew it firsthand what it meant to have a world where you didn't have Eretz Yisrael to jump to. We take it for granted that if anybody in this room wants to go for Shabbos to Eretz Yisrael, it's not a problem. No big deal. You want to hop on a plane tonight, you want to hop on a plane tomorrow afternoon, probably not too late in the afternoon. You want to hop and just go to Eretz Yisrael just for Shabbos. That's it. You want to go for Shabbos and come back and be back and stay to Sunday morning. Anybody in this room could do that. As long as you can convince your parents to give them your credit card, and you probably don't even need that, you got enough miles on your own. Anyone in this room can hop on.
Deals.
Yeah, you can figure it out better than faster than I can. You can be in Eretz Yisrael for, you don't even have to miss Shia tomorrow. You can be in Eretz Yisrael for Shabbos. You can be back here Sunday morning for Seder, and it's no big deal. That's like a mind-boggling concept. You can go spend the summer in Eretz Yisrael, go spend the year in Eretz Yisrael, go sit and learn Eretz Yisrael for 3 years, go move to Eretz Yisrael. Those opportunities on a personal level are mind-boggling, and that we can call it Dayenu. Just like HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us that gift, it's Dayenu. How much more so when HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us something as a tremendous matana for Klal Yisrael in the historical context of the sharing a plate of saving and giving Poshet the giving Klal Yisrael's goof a place where to go, that in and of itself would be Dayenu. How much more so when HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't just give us a goof. If you wanted to give us just a goof, you wanted to give us just a physical place, so Herzl's and Tebbe, Uganda plan could have passed. Probably no one knows what I'm talking about. But back in the early 1900s, there was a motion on the table that instead of going back to what was then Palestine, so why don't we just go to Uganda? The British were more than happy to give us a big chunk of land in the middle of Africa, and we could have had our own state in Africa, and believe it or not, it was on the table, it was discussion in one of the Zionist congresses, it was a very real proposition. I always find it humorous to say that. Imagine a guy saying, I'm going off to learn Eretz Yisrael. I'm going off to Entebbe for 2 years. Some yeshivas are in Entebbe, some yeshivas are outside of Entebbe. You know, we're going to Africa for a year or two to learn. Where are you doing? Where are you going? You're getting married. Where are you going off to learn? We're going to Yeshiva Gedol of Entebbe. And that would have been a reality. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'chas d'ol made it that didn't happen. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu made it that we have not just a place to rest our weary body of Eretz Yisrael, but a place that has been invigorated the Jewish neshama. And there is absolutely no question in the world that the level of ruchnius in America today is so radically different than it was 30, 40, 50 years ago for several reasons. But one of the major reasons, catalyst is the Eretz Yisrael experience. When people of my generation, a little bit before me, a little bit after me, go off to Eretz Yisrael for 1, 2, 3 years, they come back and they bring that Eretz Yisrael, they bring that Koach HaTorah and Kedusha back to America, there's not a question that has changed the landscape of religious world for us in America as well, as far as in general. But how much more so? The tremendous Akaras HaTorah and Kedusha Baruch for giving us the Ruchnius to give Eretz Yisrael. You walk around and Torah and the mitzvahs and the chesed and the Baruch Hashem, and Torah communities that are moly v'godesh v'kedusha v'tahara, ein l'shag ein l'tahara, how much HaKadosh Baruch Hu we have to Kadosh Baruch Hu. And this is leaving out. I'm not even touching the grandiose future. I'm not in Rabbi. I don't know. I can't say. And I don't know what's going to happen when and what and who. It's not my... I'm talking about just here now. I'm talking about Tavshim Pei Gimel. There is so much to be makatov to Kadosh Baruch Hu, to give the Eretz Yisrael. So we have to just find the proper method of doing it. I think that that the discussion about the proper method, Baruch Hashem, is well outdated. Only those fights and those arguments, those machloitsim and those grandiose hashkafa conversations used to take place on first dates. I said to somebody this morning, I said that in my kufa of dating, so that was usually the first major hashkafa issue that would come up about, you know, you say halal here, you say halal there, with the bracha, without a bracha, chatzi halal, one with halal, before Kaddish is Kabbalah, after Kaddish is Kabbalah, and people would make life decisions based on those nuances. So I can tell you two stories about that. One is that Baruch Hashem, Leah and I have been married, ready for 28 years. I have never, ever, ever had a discussion with my wife about, well, who says halal, when, where, and what. It just hadn't, we talked about everything else under the sun. It's just, it wasn't relevant. It's still not relevant. So that's, everyone should express a Kadosh Baruch Hu to Kadosh Baruch Hu in whatever shape or form. Not to express a Kadosh Baruch Hu to Kadosh Baruch Hu, that's a different chesed. That's between you and a Kadosh Baruch Hu. But how the norms of how to do it. So we don't have it, a Kadosh Baruch Hu from the Anshei Knesset Gedolah, how to express our Kadosh Baruch Hu. And Chanukah, it's not a free-for-all. You can't just decide you're going to, you know, do whatever you want. So, Yom HaTzmut, there was never, there hasn't been yet, by Shabbos Din, to be misaken exactly what the Tzura of the Kadosh Baruch Hu is. So each, well, like the Rambam describes in Uchus Tefillah, that in the days of Matan Torah, Tefillah didn't have a set pattern to it. Anshei Knesset Gedolah came and they put a little bit of a pattern on it. Kiddush Matan Torah could be done whatever text one wants, and the Anshei Knesset Gedolah gave a text to it. So we're still living in the Tkufa Bais Rishon vis-a-vis Medinat Yisrael. We don't have a set, it's not written in stone right now. And people should get a little bit veer away from identifying and accusing, and you know, people's particulars, how a person says, what a person says, when a person says. Don't mistakenly think that that's indicative of some grandiose hashgaf issue. I'll share with you something that happened to me on a date. This was before my wife. This was 128 years ago. So a girl asked me a certain question about hashgafa. So I'm sure that's something to do with halal. You know, I forgot what it was already. That's something to do with hashgafa. So I said to her that I quoted her a Rashi in Parshas Vayera when Avram turns to look at Sodom, but the Malach says Vayashkif Wafinei Sodom. So Rashi comments Kol Hashkafa Slara'a. I said the word hashgafa in Tanakh always has a bad connotation. There's only one place Hashkif Mon Kalchicha that it's a good part. But all other places Kol Hashkafa Slara'a. So I responded to the girl that whatever I'm going to tell you is not going to be right. It's always going to be misunderstood. So I'm telling you the truth. It's irrelevant when I say Kalash comes to wrong. So she liked that line. We didn't go out after that, but she married a very, very nice, very chashev Rosh Yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael. I guess he went to Eretz Yisrael.
You know, I don't know if I could say it any more elegantly or eloquently than Rizalski did, but you know, there's so much, and again, maybe this is a holdover from when I was young, but so much discussion about this topic and how do we celebrate it. And Jerry, without minimizing the fact that just for the people in this room, you know, it is confusing. At the end of the day, as well as everything you said, it was nice. And we appreciate it. Should I be davening in a minyan that says Hallel, you know, like full Hallel with a bracha or not? Should I go to the Zusha concert this afternoon or should I not do that? Should I, you know, how do we deal with that, especially in the context of being Sfira? So we're sensitive to the fact that those are real life, just sort of like practical questions. And it really is part of like a bigger issue that in YU, there's not always a clear-cut direction that this is the yeshiva's policy and this is what the yeshiva is doing and the yeshiva are doing this. And I think in many ways that's not a bad thing also, you know. But either way, I'm sensitive to that complexity of the issue. But I just want to maybe just highlight and reiterate something that the Rav already said. You know, in a few weeks is Yom Yerushalayim. Like, every single Baal Nefesh, when they think about the words of, like, Har Bayit Bi'adeinu, and what that day was like, what the experience was like, what it was like for people that were never standing by the Kotel to stand by the Kotel, what it must have been like for refugees in POW camps in 46 and 47 and 48, to finally come to Eretz Yisrael in 1948, to finally have one's country. Again, my grandparents being survivors of that generation, like, if that doesn't stir you, if that doesn't, like, evoke such a feeling of, like, emotion, or Kodesh Tov, Kodesh Baruch Hu, and forget about everything else. Like, who cares about the form that something takes? But because we're always sort of worried about the form of what something takes, like, we miss, like, the emotions and the Hakar Satov Shiba and the sense of just incredible sense of being Meshabeat Kodesh Baruch Hu. Like, never lose that piece because of some hashkafic issue or superficial issue or non-significant issue. Like, the inner world of a Jew is always crying out with a sense of a karsov to Kodesh Baruch Hu, especially around these days. And that can never be obfuscated or obliterated by, like, somewhat sort of superficial or technical issues. And that's often sort of the avodah for someone, for myself and for you as well, to really sort of focus on, like, the inner emotion, the inner feeling, the inner experience, shabo, as opposed to getting lost in all sorts of things that ultimately are not really significant. So, Rabbi said it beautifully, but I just wanted to reiterate that feeling. Yeah.
I noticed a phenomenon that when being in Ben Yeshiva, so when Chas Shalom and Tzaros take place, so it's very simple in Eretz Yisrael, it's very simple to be Nichnos in Tzar Shal Klal Yisrael. You're really seeing it. You go pay a shiva call, you hear the rockets flying above you. It's very simple to feel that pain and to involved. But when coming back to America and being a bit chutzlaritz, so it's kind of it's much harder to be nichnas into that tzar. So how does a ben yeshiva and just a yid, how does he cultivate that ability to be nichnas into tzar shel klal Yisrael even when in chutzlaritz?
So if you don't mind me saying so, that is such a beautiful and sensitive question, and I respect you so much for asking it and appreciate that you asked it. It's really incredibly wise beyond your years. And so I want to thank everyone heard the question. The question was, like, how does a person sort of from thousands of miles away sort of be nichnas into the realm of, like, imo nochi v'tzara? When we're in Eretz Yisrael, like, of course you feel that. And then living in, you know, Boca Raton or Muncie or Bergenfield, it's more complicated. And this was the question that you sort of posed before. You know, even if we're not in Eretz Yisrael, how do we keep sort of the spirit of, like, Aliyah or Yeshiva Eretz Yisrael, like, alive in our hearts? I think the answer is you just do it, you know. It has to get done. It has to be done. Be someone who's a Nosli v'machavero, be someone who's a Imo Nosli v'tzara, whether that's taking place in Eretz Yisrael, whether it's taking place down the street, you know. Myself, Moshe Tzvi, Rabbi Leibowitz, Rabbi Slavsky, we're all in Rabbanas. We've all been pained at moments of our life of knowing that there's a family down the block from our house who don't have enough food, who's going through Shalom Bayis issues. You know, that's, like, everywhere around us. Sometimes it's almost even, like, too much, you know, if you sort of let those if you open up those valves and sort of take in the tsar of the world, so to speak. You know, and it can be overwhelming, whether it's in this country or in Eretz Yisrael. But I think just the question is, like, what type of person do I want to be in this world? You know, do I want to be a person that's connected to the tsar amcha? And do I stop if there's a terrorist attack, or there's something going on, or there's something going on in the community, or there's a child who's struggling in my community? Do I stop and just sort of breathe that in? Take it in, like feel it in my neshama? Do I daven for that person? Do I say tefillin for that person? Do I have a limba for that person? Do I do something? Do I maybe even go to Eretz Yisrael and make a shiva call? Like, it's stopping, it's caring, it's being intentional, and it's really breathing in sort of the world into your consciousness. And I would just say, I'm sorry if I'm talking so long, you know, the older you get, the more difficult that is. You know, you have your wife, Mirz Hashem, you have your children, you have your job, you have your learning, you have this, you're that. And like, there's a thousand things going on in the world, and you're sort of like in your own little like island, your own little bubble. And like chaval, if that were to be the case. So it's taking all that in. It's no sibom chavero in a very, very real way. It's feeling the nishmas yisro in a very real way. And you sort of have to make that happen and give space for that. There's no tricks. There's no solutions to that. It's just the intentionality of being that type of person.
How should we navigate this conversation about Israel? It's like a hurtful conversation, and on the one hand, I feel like, how could I be quiet? But on the other hand, I'm young, I'm not as wise or knowledgeable as I'd like to be to engage in this conversation, and oftentimes these conversations are...
The conversation with who?
With non-Jews, with neighbors, with friends, or anyone, it seems to just come up. And I'm naturally inclined to shy away, but I'm also naturally inclined to give more of a voice. But I wouldn't be the representative of choice.
You mean in regards to the relation with Palestinians? You mean in regards to sort of the current political issues?
Yeah.
We'll leave this for you once again.
You don't have to, not everybody is qualified to be the person speaking to the Congress about the importance of the American-Israel relationship. And a person doesn't have to feel that that's necessarily their role in this world. You know, the same way that sometimes in other areas you're the ambassador for Torah, you know, so you're the ambassador for Israel, ambassador for Jewish people, and sometimes you find yourself, you know, where people ridiculing or people questioning or people, you know, not knowledgeable about, you know, let me say an Orthodox Jew, and you kind of by default become the representative. So in a certain sense, you become the representative for Klal Yisrael in terms of Eretz Yisrael as well. So of course you have to do it in a respectful manner and, you know, in a mature manner, but you have to also realize that you're not going to change, you know, many, many people's perspective, especially people who are coming with an agenda against you. The same way people have an agenda against Torah, I'm not going to all of a sudden be wowed away by, gee, I brought the Mariah, now Torah's in a Shemayim, now I'm getting, you know, Bichos B'tshuva. So the odds are somebody is a strong, you know, anti-Israel, you know, attitude to them. So you're recounting the facts of 1947, 1948 is probably not going to do the trick. So I probably wouldn't spend too much effort on that. You know, you can speak in a nice, refined, and presentable manner into a little bit, but it's probably not going to accomplish all that much in a very, very real sense. It's not good to have a screaming match with somebody over in a university setting over BDS. It's not going to.
I'm not sure how many situations you are. I mean, I'm almost never in those situations. So where you're sort of college campus, arguing BDS, although someone who's as articulate as you might be, you know, well-suited to be in that role down the road. But, you know, you deal with people all the time who are angry about something, you know, especially living in, let's say, Muncie, people that are, you know, had a horrible experience in their life. They're against from people. They're against this. They're against that. you're just who you are, like benachas, with warmth, with calm, with affection, with thoughtfulness. Like, that's it. That's like, you know, so if you're in that specific situation, maybe you're in a secular college and people are coming in front of you, so you want to sort of, you know, dama lahashiv type of situation. But I think typically just being you, gentle, darkei noam, b'ne'imus, like whatever the situation is, I think that's our only acharias and nothing more than that. We're going to wrap up with a couple more questions. Ezra, you there, Hannah?
Let's say let's say one decides that they want to go into Rabbanus or Chinuch, it would be easier to do so in America. If they're at college age right now, where they're not yet doing that, or they don't know yet if they're actually going to be that good at it, so is it like selfish to say, oh, I'm just going to plan for that and stay in America, or would it be better to just...
Am I just going to what?
Is it kind of selfish, I guess, to say, oh, I'm planning on doing that in the future, so I'm going to plan to stay in America? Or should you say, before you get even involved in that, you should say, I ideally want to live in Israel, so I'm going to plan to live in Israel.
So Ezra asked a great question, I was maybe put my own way. In other words, let's say you have somebody that wants to go into Rabbanus. Rabbanus, everyone, probably a lot of you know Rabbi Eisenstein. Is Spencer here somewhere? Anyway, Spencer Clarkfeld's uncle. Rabbi Eisenstein is now a very, very special, incredible person. Musmachov here was a Rebbe for many years in Devarie, and then still is in Gross, and he's like the Rav Mishkapayim. It's like American-style pulpit. Rabbi David Gottlieb, another graduate of here as well. But, you know, it's very rare, and that's not something you can count on to go into Rabbanus in Eretz Yisrael. If it happens, it happens after 25 years, right? So if you feel that your passion is to go into Rabbanus, and then how do you sort of navigate that vis-a-vis Eretz Yisrael? How does a person sort of think about those issues? How does one sort of navigate that journey, so to speak? As was that?
Yeah, I'm also saying, before you even get into that, should you say, it's not worth, I'd rather just live in Israel, so it's just the plan of making Aliyah.
Sure.
I'm not sure if there's a one answer fits all for this kind of thing.
Correct.
It's very, very personal. There are so many nuances to these kinds of decisions. Good to try to speak with somebody and speak with someone of a little more experience who maybe knows a little bit of the world there at Israel, knows a little bit of the world here, knows you. There's no right, no absolute right answer. And even the answer that you may reach at the age of 19, 20 may not be the same answer you have at the age of 25 and 30. I mean, people change. People change careers, people change a lot of different things. People are in Rabbanus for many years, and then they start very strong on Rabbanus in Eretz Yisrael. I think we're supposed to hear from one of them at the lunch, but I'm mistaken. Okay, so there are a lot of different nuances to that.
I just want to reiterate what the Rav said. Especially when a person thinks of moving to Eretz Yisrael, it is a very, very personalized question. What's going on with your parents? What's going on with your children? Who are you vis-a-vis, why do you feel Kesh Baruch Hu has brought you into this world, what my kolach is, and Kaya Kamshat in Eretz Yisrael. And it's so important, Ezra, for you and for anybody, to really have somebody, preferably like a Rav in your life, that really knows you, that you really feel like you are getting, I wouldn't say even like a psak, but like direction based on your own specific life. And it's not just sort of, okay, everyone should be doing X. It is very, very personal and needs to be sort of looked through that personal lens. Please. There's two last questions, please. Yeah.
So a lot of other Chagim we have is, it's very obvious, but there's always this sense just that we don't base Mikdash, and it kind of it permeates that in terms of not having completeness. Should we have that kind of sense on Yom HaTzibur, but especially considering this is the final goal, this is the steps we're getting towards, and then should we have a little sense of we're not there yet, we should be working on that?
The nature of simcha is that it's complicated. There's a very famous Yalkut Shimoni that says that the word simcha is not used by Pesach because on Pesach, so the Egyptians died on Yom Tov. So simcha, to some degree, is tempered by that. Simcha might be tempered on Sukkot, even where there is, according to the Rambam, a mitzvah d'oraisa of simcha, because according to most Rishonim, there's not a lila l'regel d'oraisa. There's not a Beis HaMikdash. It's incomplete. The nature of simcha, and that's what the Maharal says by every sort of wedding, right? The happiest moment of one's life, there's a sense of inadequacy of that simcha. Life is always some you know, symbiosis of many different emotions, many different sort of hashkafos achayim that exist in the world. And this certainly is a great example of that. You know, we have a state that's amazing. You know, we don't have a Beis Hamikdash. One can question certain things about the state. There's all sorts of things that are not there, you know, yada, 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 yada. But, you know, we can sort of feel both those things together simultaneously. And I think that's much more the way that life is bigadol, like always a symbiosis of joy and pain or something that's missing at the same time. And this certainly is no different as well. Okay, last question. Anybody want to go out with a bang? Anybody? Any interior cartoonics here that want to stand up and announce themselves? Brad Leibowitz, by the way, is not in Turi Karta, just in case you're...
I've had two conversations that stick in my mind a lot, and I'm not sure how to balance them. They're both pretty extreme. One was from a very chashuva Rosh Yeshiva, who said that, you know, if you go make Aliyah, if you have four children, one of them isn't going to be frum. And that's too steep a price to pay, and therefore you can't do it until your kids are, you know, past whatever age, similar to what Josh was referring to before. Another conversation was with a friend of mine who was making Aliyah, and he said, I've looked through Jewish history, and no galus has ended well. So even if my children struggle, and even if my children hate me for this decision, my grandchildren will thank me for it, because they'll be in our homeland, and, you know, experiencing the Aschalta de Gula, hopefully the Gula Shlema, and they will have been like the people who got out of Europe on time. So how do we balance, like, my personal decision of, like, what's best for me and my family and the people who exist right now versus the broad vision of where Klal Yisrael is heading and the role I should play in that?
I think on a nice, simple question about Rabbi Leibowitz. Thank you very much.
I think we'll turn to Rabbi Leibowitz to answer this.
So I think a person is always living in both places. You know, Aaron Lichtenstein was Rosh Yeshiva here for many years. Then finally made Aliyah. How old was he? Maybe in his 50s? How old was Aaron when he made Aliyah? Maybe earlier than that. But so anybody here who is like a Talmud of Haritzio, and I'm looking around, not with Haritzio next to here, but so his basic comment was that he had always felt when he was in the United States, he felt like he was sitting on the bleachers of a sporting event. And when you're in Eretz Yisrael, Shai, is that about right? And when he was in Eretz Yisrael, he was actually like on the field of that event. It's like the swath of Jewish history that a person really needs to feel like they're a part of. You know, the movement, beginning of the last, you know, 100 years of having a state, and I want to be a part of that and be a part of the grand sort of present and future of the Jewish people. We always have to feel that, you know? And at the same time, it took Rav Aaron a couple decades until he could actually make that decision. You know, he was getting married, and he was giving shiur, he was Rosh Yeshiva, and maybe financial, who knows, whatever the other things are. And a person is always sort of living in both those spheres, like the sphere of the Am, the sphere of the person. Sometimes in one's life, you know, the sphere of the individual person and their family concerns, that dominates. You know, you have a child you're worried about. So you say, you know what, person needs to be here, there's certain services here. And then other times you say, you know what, like, my family's okay, and I just wanted to sort of connect myself to a swath of Jewish history. But it's almost like a person's like always living with that like dual consciousness, and then the question is, which one of those pieces sort of like steps forward a little bit? You know, what piece sort of rises to the surface? And I think that's like so complicated. I'm sure you feel all the time. I feel that all the time. Every time I'm in Eretz Yisrael and I'm walking down the streets in Eretz Yisrael and I get my rent-a-car and I'm driving on Highway 1 and I'm like imagining, like, you know, Yehuda Levi in the same, probably not in a car, not on Highway 1, not with 8,000 cranes around me. Like, I almost literally cry of that feeling of being like walking in the footsteps of where my grandfather wanted to walk in Eretz Yisrael. And how am I not a part of that? You know, how do I not sort of throw my hat into that ring? And other times you just know for yourself, you know what, I can't. It's just like whatever my family situation is, or my own personal situation is, but you're always like living in that dual consciousness. You know, which is not an answer, but I think it's just sort of an expression of a reality. Wanna add to that? Guys, I really want to thank you for being here. I want to thank Ben. And most importantly, I want to thank you for caring enough to be here, to have these conversations. You guys are in the miut of 21-year-olds in this country that are passionate about thinking about these issues, and what a bracha it is to be exposed to that, be connected to that, to be in this environment where we're even like talking about these things. And I just, for myself, and I'm sure for Eslovsky as well, we're always here to have these conversations. But most importantly, to always be thinking about who am I, where can I fulfill the Ratzon Hashem, how am I part of the future of the Jewish people, and just to have those conversations that are so important. And thank you guys for being here.
And Ben, you want to thank you I just going to put on now the cab. Rob Waxer speaking. Everyone is
Yeah, sure.